giving them super partners that fit into chiral and vector super multiplets, making sure the gauge invariance was SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. The supersymmetry led us to two Higgs doublets, as did anomaly cancellations. And we imposed the R parity condition, which is potentially an ad hoc thing, but is a challenge for any fundamental theory to produce. Then we specialized to the sector for the part of the Lagrangian that described the scalar neutral particles and completely explored the Higgs sector, and in particular, the remarkable prediction that the Higgs mechanism is derivable in supersymmetry rather than something you impose. And then we looked at the spectrum of physical particles implied by that sector and the experimental situation for them. Then we went and looked at superpartners themselves and their properties, and looked at the particularly good windows for superpartners coming from virtual processes where there's no tree level diagram, and so the superpartners can come into the loop on the same footing basically as the standard model ones, and so we're much more sensitive to those. And now finally we'll pretty much work on collider physics today and the opportunities there. So the Fermilab collider is running and could present us with data at any time, but its intensity is marginal for many purposes. What we're really hoping for is the LHC. here's its current startup schedule. The LHC is likely to be on time because the management of it is very sophisticated. Using modern techniques, they basically have a spreadsheet such that if you don't, at noon on some day, if you're behind in achieving the goals you were supposed to be achieving, then they immediately put some money and some people toward getting them done that afternoon. And they don't wait around to find out later that something wasn't done. It takes a long time to just cool down the machine, because you have to have everything in vacuum chambers to evacuate the particles and have it work. Then step by step, hopefully in April of 2007, they start to test one piece after another, first separate beams. In June, they hope to collide two beams a little bit, and by November to have a useful luminosity. if they can run at this kind of luminosity for extended periods of time, then they will be beginning to accumulate orders of magnitude more data than Fermilab. And so by about June of 2008, they expect to get some amount like 5 inverse femtobarns, which it would have taken Fermilab, with its sort of current running things, 5 or 6 years to get. And then if the luminosity goes up and they keep running, they will go to huge amounts and really test things. There is a lot of interest coming now about whether we can learn to interpret the data from LHC. It's a hadron collider. I'll give you some sense of the difficulties of recognizing the physics. And some efforts have begun. One that more and more people are picking up on got dubbed the LHC Olympics, and you can go to that website. At that website is posted a file which contains the results of the first year of LHC running, simulated by some people. So experimenters can actually go there and look for the signals, if any, in that, and theorists who feel like they can handle it can do it. And on, I forgot to write it, on July 25th and 26th at CERN, there is a two-day meeting at which the results of the first year of LHC running, as posted on that website, will be presented by people who've made discoveries, and people will discuss techniques for extracting and interpreting the physics from that and beginning to learn how to do that for the time when real data comes. We've been involved in that process, and so particularly two of my students, Jake Borgeli and Piyush Kumar, and I and some others, have been putting together, in response to many requests, a sort of primer. Actually, the first exercise started at the Perimeter String Phenomenology Conference in March, where we did a version of this, and that gave rise to considerable interest and many requests for this primer or something equivalent. So we're writing it up, and it should be posted within a couple weeks. You can get to it through the that web page at CERN, and later other ways. And it shows you how to take all the resources on the web and use them to calculate, to do the sorts of calculations you need to go from a theory to data or vice versa. So I'll go into some of the physics details about those kinds of issues today. First point to make is that if you make a typical superpartner decay, again, just using the Lagrangian, and the width is the square of some matrix element with a typically a two-body or sometimes a three-body decay, the width is always proportional to the mass, except in unusual cases, but typically it is, with a coupling squared, something like alpha 2. And so the width is typically a few GeV for a 100 or 200 GeV particle. And if you convert that to a lifetime, you see that the superpartners decay inside the beam pipe where the collisions occur. So you will never be able to see the superpartners directly. The lightest superpartner should be stable and escapes, but you don't see it directly either. So you should look. You have to learn to look for their decay products. So now let's go through a few examples of how we would do that. So suppose that you produce the lightest partner. It's going to be stable. We expect all the gay genos to be light from the kinds of arguments I gave you about fine-tuning issues. So if you've just produced two of the LSPs, which kinematically would be the easiest thing you can do, then I don't know if there's somebody up there. One of these search lights is very bright, and it's getting in my eyes all the time. If that one could be removed or turned off, it would be helpful. But we'll make it if not. But if someone up there knows about that, that would be good. If you produce two of these guys, then in general, in the event, nothing happens, and so you don't know there was an event. Thank you. Good. You can have what are called monojets, where one of the initial particles radiates, say, a gluon, and the fundamental event happens. And that tells you that there was something. So you get a jet at large angles in your detector, and you have to figure out why. The trouble is that there are lots and lots of ways that can happen in the standard model itself. For example, what you call a jet in the standard model has usually some, what you call a jet in a detector has some threshold, say 100 GeV, to eliminate events with soft particles. So it'll happen a lot that you'll get one like this and one that's softer, and it'll look like one of these events, but it won't be. So this is really impossible to untangle, and you can never search for that kind of channel at a hadron collider. So it's not going to be how we learn what's happening. A channel that is more promising and could be found is when you make the lightest neutralino and one or the other of the second and third. I put one or the other because in some models, one of them is coupled like a higgsino and so proportional to a little small mass, and you don't see it so easily, but the other one won't be there. So here's an example of what might happen then. Quark and antiquark in the colliding protons go through a Z, make an LSP, and the second neutraline. The second one can decay by essentially the inverse of this. Remember, I'm just taking the vertices from the Lagrangian, and they're all standard model vertices with, as long as you just put two of them to be superpartners. And you have to go back and remember that the mass eigenstates are combinations of the standard model eigenstates. So this one can decay through a Z to N1, and the Z might decay to L plus L minus. So in the detector, what you see is missing transverse energy. You can only do missing transverse energy at a hadron collider, because when the two protons collide, you don't know where the other quarks and gluons in the protons went, so you can't ever do any calculation or evaluation of the longitudinal energy. But whatever happened to these guys, they didn't produce transverse energy, and so you're perfectly all right to study that. So you look at missing transverse momentum or energy, and everything works fine. So this is an event where what you see in the detector is typically L plus L minus, where they came from that, and large missing energy, and that we call its signature. Sometimes this decay will be dominated by a photon instead of those. Again, if the kinematics is such that decays to fermions are suppressed because of the number of hexenos in the channel, since hexenos always couple proportional to mass. So there's a signature, which we'll come back to, L plus L minus. For all channels, there's some background, except maybe one that I'll show you. Here, if you produce just a pair of W's in the standard model, each W decaying to lepton neutrino, then you get the two charged leptons and the two neutrinos that give missing energy. So to say that you had a signal, you have to know the cross-section for this and typically where these guys go, and demonstrate that you have an excess of events that behave like this, particularly in regions where these are unlikely to go kinematically given how they arise. So you have to calculate that stuff pretty well to figure out what's happening. Another channel going up in mass, more or less qualitatively, is the lightest neutralino plus the first chargeno. So now that can happen by an up and a down quark in the protons making a W, which then make neutralino chargeno, or you can have a T-channel diagram like that one. The chargeno can decay a number of different ways. If leptons are light, this might be an important decay. It gives a charged lepton, a neutrino that escapes, and the lightest superpartner that escapes. Here it can be this neutrino, and here there'll always be a channel with a W, and this will dominate unless these guys are light. And it could have a direct decay if stops are lighter than it to that channel. But in all these cases, actually, the signature of a chargeno is one charged lepton in the large missing energy. Again, there's background from this kind of channel, which you have to evaluate if you're going to say you saw a signal. But one of the messages that you should be getting is that all of the superpartner channels are visible, except the very lightest one. And so you can see them and do something. You can discover them, and then you can start to study their properties. One of the easiest ones with a relatively little background is called the trilepton channel. Now you make two that decay, both C1 and N2. Again, you can produce them through an S-channel W or a T-channel lepton or quark. Then the decay can go through various channels, but here's a decay of N2 that we already looked at, and here's a decay of C1 that we already looked at, and you can add the other decays. But what you get are three charged leptons and missing energy. And there's, from the final state, no jets in the event, so it looks quite clean in the detector. You can get initial state jets radiated sometimes. So this channel is one of the most promising ones to look for, and it'll be one of the ones looked for most quickly at LHC. The the cross-section times branching ratio depends on the masses of these guys and on the various couplings that went in there. There are backgrounds, again, but these are rather small backgrounds, if you look, because they require two suppressed decays compared to what might happen. And again, things go in, for the backgrounds, things go in predictable places, and so you can take care of that. Gluinos are likely to be, naively, the best thing you can do at LHC because they're produced with color. They have a large color charge. They're produced with a much larger cross-section. And they give a lot of activity that, in general, that is different. So there are nice ways to see them. So you can produce them through a diagram like this. At Fermi Lab, this kind of diagram and this one would dominate. At LHC, you're at a higher energy. You're probing the structures of the protons more deeply with the higher energy. And so you're really getting many gluons in the proton. And so these diagrams actually dominate the production at LHC when you put in the numbers. The decays can be very interesting. You might have a nice channel like this, and I'll show you a concrete example in a minute where the gluino happens to be heavier than the top plus the stop. Remember, I gave you some arguments why the stop might be relatively light. So then that decay produces, from the top, you get the normal decay to WB with a B quark and a charged lepton and a neutrino that escapes. And maybe the chargino, maybe the stop gives you this kind of decay mode to a B and a chargino, and then the chargino decays the way we saw. So you get an event with Bs and leptons and jets and missing energy that is, it's fakeable, but it's getting complicated enough that it's not so easy to fake. If you happen to have heavier squarks, then they would appear mainly in intermediate states here. So a squark can decay, gluino can decay to squark quark, then this can decay to chargino, quark, and so forth. And remember, you'll pair produce, typically, these guys. One of the most important things of all, and a thing which could lead to almost an instant discovery, if we're lucky, of supersymmetry, is same-sign dileptons. It's a very nice, very supersymmetric feature. Gluinos are Majorana particles because of the 2 degrees of freedom that they have coming from gluons, being the partners of gluons. If they're Majorana particles, they can decay like themselves or like their antiparticle. Majorana particles are their own charge conjugate. So if you produce a pair of these guys, then when a gluino decays, it might give you a definite sign lepton, depending on the path it follows here, but it can give you either sign. So from a pair of gluinos, you can get a pair of positive charged leptons or a pair of negative ones or opposite sign ones. In the standard model, if you look, if you try and write down standard model processes that give you same sign isolated dileptons, you can't do it. There are no standard model processes because there are no Majorana particles in the standard model. And it simply can't happen. You can get one from a secondary decay, say a B quark decaying leptonically into a charm quark, but then that looks like a jet with the B and the charm and the stuff the charm decays into in one jet. So if you never count leptons that are sort of inside a jet like that, then you won't be confused about that. So the same sign dileptons is very characteristic of supersymmetry for profound reasons because of the Majorana nature of the particle, and in principle has no background in the standard model. Detectors can malfunction sometimes, so a given detector will somehow, sometimes a jet might look like a charged lepton in the detector one time in 10,000, say. And so you have to know a little bit about your detector and how it functions in that regard. But basically, that's an extremely clean and useful channel. So the same sign dileptons is one of the many ways, one of several ways that you can get a really clean, quick signal. 10 events like that would be a discovery. If you look at the kinds of models that people have studied in the literature, a kind of interesting sociological thing happened. People a few years ago started constructing what are called benchmark models. Basically models where you design something that's not too inconsistent with all the existing constraints, and you can study those models. And they teach you how to look in a detector by studying in detail those kinds of models. Well, some clever people at CERN set up a bunch of benchmark models. They wanted the world to think that the LHC and its detectors and its budget should be really strongly supported by everybody. And so they picked a set of benchmark models where you couldn't discover anything at Fermilab or at a linear collider that was then being discussed. And somehow they conned people into taking them seriously. So there's a set of benchmark models out there that say things are heavy and LHC can discover them, but you can't discover them at Fermilab. Partly for politics and partly for fun, we constructed a set of benchmark models based on string constructions where you start with string constructions. Of course, you can't make full derivations, but at each step, you can choose a reasonable string alternative. I'll just show you two of those models. And they tend to give much lighter spectra than the political ones did. So they in fact, are encouraging for discoveries at Fermilab and such things. So here's a model. Details of it don't matter from the point of view of analogy, but it does have that decayed top stop in it. The gluinos are under 500 GeV, or about 500 GeV. The stop is about 245 GeV. 50% of the time, this decays to that channel in that model. Remember, you can once you put in the masses, you can calculate everything. So you can calculate all the aspects of these models out as much as you want. The chargino is 106 GeV. This has essentially 100% decay branching ratio to that chargino and a B, and the chargino branching ratio is essentially 100% to W in the LSP, which weighs 89 GeV and is a good candidate for dark matter. Here's a different kind where, and again, about a 500 GeV gluino decays to a 500 GeV B squark and a B. And again, you can go through the different channels and see a nice signature. You can get some models that actually have a style that is somewhat lighter than other particles, a few GeV, and so that tends, decays like the second neutralino decay to a style tau bar, and the chargino decay is dominated by style. So you get events that are dominated by finding taus, which can be found at hadron colliders, can be detected. And so you get a lot of nice characteristic things. What I've been trying to do for a few minutes is just give you a sense that the theory predicts a large number of channels that are detectable at hadron colliders that you can observe, you can make discoveries, and we'll look at some of the properties of these things. One kind of exercise you could do to get a sense of what's happening is take some model that you do calculations for, and in that model, the different mass parameters are related. So in that model, you could parameterize things as a function of a chargino mass. So here is a calculation of the number of events, the cross-section at Fermilab energies, as just as a function of chargino mass, the number of superpartner events you get as a function of chargino mass at Fermilab. So it's a somewhat long calculation, but you just simply take the different channels, write all the masses in terms of the chargino mass, and carry out this just to get a sense of what can happen. And you can take the minimum possible rate, and you can see that For example, if Fermilab had run at its original plant intensity, it would already be here. And so you can probe Fermilab up to some chargeinal mass like 250 GeV if it had run at that intensity. So LHC will go much beyond that, and Fermilab will eventually get there. If you want to look at the status of Fermilab, you can go to fnal.gov and click on Fermilab today, and click on, most days they have an accelerator status, and you get a histogram of the integrated luminosities over the past 3 years each week at Fermilab. Here's an example of a typical analysis you'll do. So these are number of events per bin of 3 GeV with the signature. We saw various signatures on the plots. You have opposite sign dileptons, so an L plus L minus. So we saw several channels where you could get that coming from the second neutralino or combinations of other neutralinos. One way you can get that is a direct production of the Z in its decay. Then if you make TT bar events, you get opposite sign dileptons in many ways. From, for example, each top can decay into a W and a B, and the W can give you a lepton. You'll get opposite sign ones. And some of the supersymmetry signatures. So if this is what you see, and it's plotted as a function of the mass of the lepton pair where you combine mu's and e's, because they're easier to see than tau, so you don't include tau's. But then you can say, okay, well, maybe that's a signature, but if I did it a little wrong, that's not so different from the top part. So you just redo it a little bit. You know that the top part can give you the same flavor or opposite flavors, because the W's from the top are decaying independently. So they can both give you, you can get any combinations of flavors and charges. Still opposite sign because of the TT bar nature. So you take these in a mass spin, which is electrons plus muons, minus the number which would be equal to these in principle if there were no detector issues and so forth and fluctuations. And that, you see, gets rid of most of the top. This is up at nearly 400 here, and it's down to sort of below 10 here. So that's just one way you can cut out most of that top background. You also cut down the supersymmetry signal, and you completely eliminate the Z signal when you do that. But now the supersymmetry signal is a very clear standout thing, and you have no doubt whatsoever that you've made a discovery. And from the kinematical features of it, you can learn something about the masses of the particles and so forth. So there are many analyses like these people have learned to do. And you'll do ones like that as you go through all the data and pin it down. So the first thing I've really shown you is that you will find signals for supersymmetry at LHC. There's not any real doubt of that, but if it's there, you'll find it. Well, that's not quite fair. You can think of tiny corners of parameter space where it's harder to find. But over almost all the parameter space, if the signals are there, you will find them. And it won't be too hard to see some things there. Now the question is, can we learn from those raw signals? Is it enough if we tell you, okay, light supersymmetry exists? Is that all you need to know to do the physics you want to do? How can we connect that back to the Lagrangian we started from? How can we learn about the underlying theory? So you have to start to think about what's going to be measured there and how to interpret it. So what experimenters measure is only the cross-section for some signature times the branching ratio into that signature. That's all they do. Experimenters take a given signature defined by saying you have the following things that occur in the detector with a certain amount of particles of one kind and another of various energies and so forth. In addition, they can measure certain kinematical distributions, like where, as a function of some pair mass, like on the previous transparency, where does the rate drop off? But you don't see specific particles. You don't see the kinds of things in the theorist Lagrangian. I showed you a couple times by looking at the Chargino and Higgs channels that if you simply count the number of things you can measure in those sectors, that the number of observables isn't enough to invert and get the Lagrangian parameters from that for several different ways. I showed you that. For the Higgs case, you will be able to measure the cross-section times branching ratio, and you will be able to measure the mass of the Higgs for the lightest one and maybe some of the heavier ones under almost all conditions. But what do you want LHC to tell you? It isn't going to directly tell you the origin of electroweak symmetry breaking. You want information from it that lets you relate to the theory and figure out those things. And it isn't going to tell you about supersymmetry breaking directly, but the pattern of the masses and the cross sections and things is giving you information about such things. So you need to turn it around and go and figure out those things. There's been very little work on that kind of thing. So I'm just going to describe for you some of the considerations and issues that come in. Even after you get some data from the collider, we have the issue of connecting high and low scales. We've only talked a little bit about it, and we only used it when we looked at deriving the Higgs mechanism and understanding that. So I briefly mentioned, and I want to emphasize it again, if you're going to say you have this great theory and it's going to describe everything, then if you want to check that you predict what's observed at LHC, you have to do a top-down calculation. You have to figure out what tangent beta is. You have to figure out how mu is generated. And you have to do all the renormalization group running. And in a minute, I'll just illustrate some more of the renormalization group running issues for you. And those are model dependent. You don't really know whether there's intermediate scale matter. I won't illustrate what happens if there is, but whatever matter there is changes those equations. You don't know exactly where to start running and to stop. And you can have attractor points that you run to regardless of the details of the data. And then remember the complexity of the Lagrangian parameters and how that affects things. So it's important to study these issues, and it would be good to study them particularly ahead of time. The two main successes of supersymmetry so far, in a sense, the gauge coupling unification and the electroweak symmetry breaking, depend on the renormalization group running. So let me go through the rest of the channels that I haven't mentioned and just sketch briefly the way they work and the importance for a few minutes. For superpotential parameters, here's the Yukawa couplings and the way they run, and here's mu. Remember, in each case, you just look at the one-loop diagrams, and you get a first-order differential equation where the terms are described by the different kinds of diagrams you can get. So if you're writing an equation for the top Yukawa, then this Higgs exchange diagram comes in with the top Yukawa squared because of that. And this one with a W comes in with the G2 squared and so forth. Notice that the equation for mu is proportional to mu. So that's what is equivalent to that. In the perturbation theory, that's what's equivalent to the non-renormalization theorem. That is, if you start with mu 0, then you don't generate a mu by the running or from the radiative corrections in this pattern. So this is one way of saying that. And similarly for the Yukawa couplings. And also the sine of mu is invariant under renormalization group running. So from those equations, you can deduce and construct a lot of important things. The Okay, genome masses, one of the important things we want to know is if they're unified or not, because you can have the gauge couplings unified, but not those masses. They satisfy an equation like that coming from that diagram, so proportional to the mass and the g squared from the vertices of that, where the beta functions for supersymmetry are those. That's the same equations as the gauge coupling, so at one loop, the gauge genome masses and gauge couplings are proportional and run that way, or if you like, you can write this equation that's true at one loop, not beyond one loop. The trilinear couplings are very different. You can take a simplified model to see one of them. Then it has a term proportional to itself, which isn't there, but it has other terms proportional to, for example, a large Yukawa coupling. And it has terms that are proportional to the matrices, Yukawa matrices, so you can generate off-diagonal ones here. So these guys, even if they were zero at the high scale, aren't zero at the low scale. You pick up contributions to them at the low scale, and so you really have to pay attention there and distinguish between the high and the low scale theories, and you can generate large contributions from other things, even if they're not present in your high scale theory. Similarly, B has a term which isn't renormalized, but it has another term proportional to mu, which is, and so B will in general be generated, whether mu is or is not. The scalar masses are the ones which, when they're colored, basically run up from that. And here's the equation that comes in. And here you have actually the quadratic Casimir operator at the two vertices and a gauge coupling squared. So the right-hand side is negative definite in that case. And they simply all increase from the input high scale down to the electroweak scale. And I showed you briefly part of the phases, but not all of it. Here's more of the phase information. Phase of mu doesn't run, I showed you, and the phase of the gauge genome masses runs at two loops, so it's typically no more than about 1%. The phase of B can be relatively large, depending on the relative sizes of these things, and again, it can be generated by different terms. So you will have that coming in, and similarly, the phase of the trilinears can come in from different sources. So you have to be careful about those things. Now I'm going to turn to more of the real-world issues about the colliders. You have the basic picture of you produce superpartners, you'll see evidence. Now I want to turn to thinking about what we can learn from the stuff I told you last time and a little bit of this. You can see that with two escaping LSPs, then you can never simply deduce the mass of a superpartner from the hadron collider data. There will always be two escaping things that could have shared the energy in different ways. So you can't make a mass peak of any kind. So to answer questions, we have to develop some new techniques that just haven't existed before. And more people are starting to work on this kind of stuff now. There's some older papers that we've been involved with and others, but three of the most modern papers are these three here with somewhat different and overlapping groups of people trying to figure out ways to answer the physics questions we want from the Hadron Collider data. So to reiterate the challenges, let me show you what might be presented now as the data. So there's a big international meeting at CERN after 1 year of running, and here's what the experimenters tell you. So they say, if you look at the number of events for that year, which got 10 inverse femtobarns of data. Then the number of same sign dileptons they found in events with three or more jets and large missing energy was here. So just about 19 or 18 events there. And opposite sign dileptons with the same conditions, quite a few more events, about 120. So that's just one point on that graph. One can make a number of graphs like that. Here's another one. Single lepton, like could come from a Giardino, with two or more jets. And opposite sign events, here's the numbers of events, much larger numbers. So one could keep looking at graphs like that, which are instructive, or one could just make a table for all of them. So here's the summary that you might get presented. There's a signal of something, and that's all you know is what's on these two transparencies that I showed you. That's all the LEP the LHC experimenters can tell you. They can't tell you anything about D-brains versus heterotic theories or any other stuff. This is it. So the number of events with no leptons and two jets is this, no leptons and three jets, always large missing energy, cut of 100 GeV for all of these. And then a couple of kinematic things. They say, define an effective mass, which is simply the total energy of all of the jets in the event added up, plus the total missing energy. That's this M effective variable. And they say, then you get a distribution of events, and it has a peak at some point. Peak is at 737.5 GeV for that distribution. And another distribution is the opposite sign lepton pair mass distribution. You look at opposite sign leptons and again make a plot of the number of events versus mass, and it peaks at 7.5 GeV. So those are facts that they measure, and that's all they measure. From that, you've got to figure out something about the world. So what do? So that's the kind of techniques we're trying to develop. The way that I think we'll be able to proceed most successfully is this kind of procedure. So first, without any details, you can look at some patterns. So here, we construct a number of theories. And I'm not going to go through the details of what these theories are, A and B and C, and we can write, say, 300 columns. They're examples of theories where we start with string theories of different kinds. We go to four dimensions. And there are always some choices to make when you do that. We break supersymmetry, and there's some choices to make. And each time you make a different choice, you keep going, and you get down to the signature. So here are, say, 15 different possible signatures. And I've explained what all of these are, basically. I showed you some B-rich events from the decay of a gluino to a spottom and a B, or to top and stop, and some peaks of distributions. And if you look at a given one of these, you can see that already, even with just four signatures, several of them are different. And you look at the data, and you see the data is like this. And so you can throw away the approaches that don't match the data in these general patterns. And what that'll do is focus you in on certain kinds of compactifications and certain kinds of supersymmetry breaking and certain ways of stabilizing moduli and so forth. And if we do a good job of this, then it may be that you can actually, that it's very powerful, and we can be focused toward the right kind of theory, and then, of course, we can zoom in. But if you look at one pattern, of course, you can't say anything. It's only by looking at a number of patterns that you can get this kind of information. If you aren't going to be able to measure the mass of the second neutralino or the mass of the Chargino, probably not the mass of the gluino even. If you want to distinguish theories by measuring those specific masses, you'll most likely fail. But if you use the signatures, one step removed from the masses, you have a chance. So basing the approaches on the signature space, which is kind of interesting to think about both theoretically and phenomenologically. For example, you can talk about, in the signature space, you can define the distance between different signatures, and you can define a distance between parameter sets, and you can look at 2- and 3-point correlation functions if you like to do things theoretically. If you really only use the signatures and look at numbers of events with a given kind and use as much information as possible, then it's pretty clear that you can learn some important things. I'll show you an example where you can clearly exclude some approaches even if you can't measure the specific masses. And there are some ways to measure quantities like tangent beta and the LSP mass that we're getting towards. Some of this work, some of the things I'm talking about here are unpublished, but we think we have ways to do some of it, which I'll briefly go over. For example, even though we can't measure the neutralino and chargino masses, if you imagine that your high scale theory had that those masses unified, then when you go down to the low scale, there are some relations between the masses. And those are determined by the running and the relative masses at the high scale. Then the fact that you've got some relations means that certain numbers of leptons and certain energies of leptons are favored over others. Whereas if the masses weren't unified, then different amounts are favored. So it actually isn't too hard to show, and I'll give you just one graph that indicates that kind of thing, that we probably can test at least, it'd probably be not too hard to show that Gugino masses aren't unified if they're not. It'll be a little harder to establish they are, but we probably can do that. Even though we can never measure an individual Gugino mass, if we move the question in the right direction, there are some things we can do. Similarly, a number of things are sensitive to tangent beta. If you try and find one place to measure tangent beta, you cannot do that. But if you try and find things sensitive to it and combine them in the right way, you have the possibility of doing some things. So this is only going to work if theorists really think about it and do something. The kind of theoretical issue you would be following then to make patterns and look at things is start off in your amoeba somewhere and go through different stages of compactification and supersymmetry breaking. And at different stages, you might, for example, stabilize moduli, and then you might have some implications for inflation. But some of the stuff that's there will continue down to affect the collider signatures too, and these will be related. And you can relate what goes on here to the possibility of small neutrino masses. We know something about that. And in fact, it's never been shown that any string theory implies light neutrino masses. That's an open problem. It's been shown that at least one doesn't, but never that one does, that any do. And you can relate these things to the Yukawa couplings and so forth. So this kind of physics is, things are getting related, but not in any real simple way. You can get a little more concrete than the patterns this way. So here's what would, again, two signatures, trilepton events and same sign dilepton ones, and a bunch of different string constructions. And the key point is not what these are, but that they're in different places on this pattern. So if you construct these things, they fall all over the pattern, typically. And so when you know where you are experimentally, you've learned something. Now, these are for one particular parameter set, so you have to spread them out by varying the parameters. And what evidence we have is that they don't spread too far. Here's an example with just 4 constructions and 2 sets of parameter points. So they move around a bit, but they don't move too far. This is all kind of work that's ongoing, so I can't give you completely separate answers. If you take that so-called M-Sugra theory, where you only have four real parameters. Then here's a plot with a particular cross-section for, this is events with no leptons and two jets or more, and this is opposite sign dileptons and jets and missing energy. Then what you can show is that that so-called Amsugra approach is inside this blue blob on there. That is, let its parameters vary over all the values they can take that aren't already inconsistent with some known data. And they all fall inside there. So if you do the experiments and you make these plots for a bunch of things, and we've done this now and we have the results, partly in a paper and partly on a website, then you find, if you found a single experimental point outside that region, you would know that that approach could not describe nature. It might be that for 10 combinations of these, it would be in the region, but for one, it was outside. These points are just some of those string constructions to show you that being outside a given region for that is not particularly unlikely. That is, it's not true that you're always inside. So a given approach has a footprint like that blue one, which is finite. It doesn't cover the whole parameter space, and that's very powerful. You can do more analysis with these things. Here's a case where this is the same Amsugra plot that I just showed you, but this is a log plot, so it looks different to spread it out. And now superimposed are different colors for the amount of relic density of the dark matter for those points. So there are several things to notice. One is these kinds of points, the yellow and gold one, for example, correspond to a small but not terribly small amount of dark matter. And they're all over the plot in terms of numbers of events. They don't come in any particular place. They depend on the other parameters. Getting the right amount of dark matter is the right shade of blue, and everywhere on the plot, again, there are some examples of that. So in particular, finding events at colliders, finding light as superpartners at colliders, is not going to tell you the dark matter content. You can be all over the plots. Again, you have to deduce, as I said last time, the relic density. Here's the same plot in black. That is, the Amsugra region is the black one. Added for contrast are, for the blue stars, one particular string construction. And since this is a log plot, these are very different from those to show you that you can distinguish. And more important for the moment, the Amsugra case, but simply removing the constraint of unified Gugino masses, shifts a large number of points off the Amsugra region. So you see it's very sensitive. Just these two signatures, you get very different numbers of events if you simply change the requirement of unified Gugino masses. Once you know that it's sensitive, then you can do this kind of analysis. And this is the indication that I mentioned that it will be pretty easy for us to tell whether Gugino masses are unified by just looking at several different signatures, even though we can never measure the separate Gugino masses. And for many of the questions that we want to answer, we'll be able to find ways to proceed like that. Another important point that I won't torture you with in any detail, because it's very complicated to look at separate stuff. We will be able to study issues of CP violation at the hadron colliders. People have worried about whether you can do that. If you start with protons, for example, that's not CP even for an initial state. So how can you study CP violation? And detectors aren't CP invariant. So how can you figure out what how to study? You're going to get apparent CP violation at colliders for several reasons. In fact, we'll be able to do it because we know the standard model, and we'll be able to simulate what the standard model will give, which won't be zero in many cases for the CP violating effects, and then compare the real data with what the standard model should give. And there are certain intrinsically CP violating observables like triple scalar products that are, if you take the scalar product of two vectors in an event, two momenta, say, that defines the plane that they're, the cross product of two vectors defines the plane or the normal to the plane, and then you take the scalar product of that with some other vector in the event and count the number above and below, that is a time reversal violating or intrinsically CP violating observable. And we'll be able to form those. We won't know whether it came from chargenos or neutralinos, but we'll be able to know that it came from events beyond the standard model. And if we don't find something simple and straightforward like supersymmetry to untangle, but something else, then it might have very large CP violation. Supersymmetry will have CP violation, but probably not large, and we'll be able to figure out some of that stuff. But I won't go into details on that. So I will show you two more transparencies to tie things together and then stop. So here's the way I've tried to encourage you to think about what will happen. Down here, there will be a lot of experiments that will provide us with some information, but not with very clean, interpretable things. Up here live a bunch of string theorists who can't really see or understand that stuff very well. And in general, we'll have two sets of information, and without both of them, we don't have any chance of figuring out what's going on. So long as the theory is such that you can go back and forth, and the perturbativity that allows you to do that is extremely encouraging from the gauge coupling unification and the electroweak symmetry breaking, supersymmetry then plays a role. It's not, you don't have supersymmetry because it plays this role, but it's more powerful than other things because it plays this role. If you have supersymmetry, you can control the theory and connect high and low scales. Without the supersymmetry, there's probably no way to relate these two domains, even if they were both there. So to succeed, we need experiments, which requires experimenters and also funding and societies that want experiments. We need string theorists to understand the theory at this scale and move it toward being realistic, and we need what you might call four-dimensional theorists, because neither of these groups can connect the top and the bottom and make sense of what's going on. But with it all, we have a possibility of actually doing what we hope for. It's fun to ask what kinds of information and data you might need to get the standard, to get the theory right. If you look back at the history, very little data was needed to get the standard model right, actually. When you look at what was known at the time when it was written down, then you see that a few facts were known from the experimental point of view. The currents that led to interactions were vector and axial vector as opposed to scalar or tensor. You knew parity violation occurred. That in modern language is that fermions are chiral. You knew that weak interactions were weaker, which was important. You knew that there were a lot of hadrons, and they had a spectrum that was consistent with something like quarks, and you knew about deep inelastic scattering, and you knew there were two types of neutrinos, which suggested two families. And you knew that gauge theories existed, and clever theorists then put it all together from there. So what kind of data do we need to get the supersymmetric standard model and move us toward a string theory, maybe a four-dimensional high-scale version of the string theory or the full, say, 10-dimensional version? Well, we already know gauge coupling unification. We know there's no deviations from the standard model at left, and we know a certain amount about these things. This is the part down here that we don't yet know anything about. We might even know enough about this sector, but we don't know for sure that we do because we need confirmation. But the bottom half of this, we don't know. So far, this is not enough, apparently, to do it, but we can hope that this is if enough smart people focus on such things and work on them. Thank you. A super partner.
Super.
Thank you very much, Rob. I hope you're going to be ready too, because we need help.